session twice over to two different Chinese gamblers. This sad decline of the Hawaiian state had caused deep concern among the missionary families, and although some men of rectitude, like Micah Hale, loyally supported the royal line, they were grieved when attempts were made to legalize opium and lotteries. Even so, had the customary succession of amiable and handsome kings continued, and had they allowed their iron-willed New England advisers to run the kingdom, Micah Hale and his responsible associates would probably have been able to keep the tottering monarchy viable. But on January 29, 1891, royalty of a far different sort ascended the throne, and trouble was inescapable. Queen Liliuokalani was a short, moderately stout woman of regal bearing. She had large, determined lips, a high pile of graying hair, and wrists laden with jewels. In black satin, fringed with ostrich feathers, and bearing a feathered ivory fan, she was an imposing woman with a stubborn will. It was her custom to deliver important messages seated in front of a golden-yellow cape of feathers, both because this was an antique royal custom which set off her dignity, and because she was slightly crippled and did not move with grace. For many years she had been plain Lydia Dominis, strong-minded wife of a slim Howley of Italian descent, with whom she lived in a large white mansion called Washington Place. Upon the death of her brother, the king, she ascended the throne, bringing with her a desire to reverse the trend toward Howley domination and a determination to cast aside New England influences like Micah Hale. She was a highly intelligent woman and had traveled to the courts of Europe, where the role played by Queen Victoria impressed her, and she had a love of political power. Had she acquired the throne immediately after the passing of the Kamehameha, she might have made Hawaii a strong and secure monarchy, for she had a lively imagination and much skill in manipulating people. But she attained ultimate power too late. Republicanism had infected her people. Sugar had captured her islands. And although she did not know it, her enemy was no longer the stately political leader Micah Hale. It was the gun-running, determined plantation owner Wild Whip Hawksworth. Against the former, she might have had a chance. Against the latter, she was powerless. Without ever identifying her enemies, this headstrong, imaginative woman tried to combat republicanism, congregationalism, and sugar. But she succeeded only in driving those disparate forces together in a coalition. Hawaiians, who were tired of the monarchy and its silly pretensions, conspired against the queen, although most who joined the coalition did so in hope of currying favor with the Americans. Missionary families came out boldly against the corruption, absolutism, and paganism of the monarchy. But many who cried loudest in public against these evils also owned businesses that would prosper under American rule. And lawyers were forceful in their arguments against the excesses of the monarchy and in defense of human rights, but mostly they fought to protect sugar. As the queen's obstinate reign continued, the coalition against her became more powerful. In early 1893, the headstrong woman determined to eliminate the influence of men like the statesman Micah Hale and his insolent nephew, Whip Hawksworth. Accordingly, she let it be known that she intended to abrogate the present constitution, which hampered her absolute power, to put the legislature under royal control, and to revoke the voting rights of many citizens and generally restore the ancient prerogatives of the monarchy. She was a notable figure when she made this disclosure. Queenly, posed against yellow feathers dating back 200 years, a lei of plumeria about her shoulders, and a train of satin 4 feet long piled about her crippled foot. As she spoke, she did not make it clear, but it was her intention to take Hawaii back to the good old days that France had enjoyed in 1620. That afternoon, Wild Whip Hawksworth summoned the Committee of Nine, and his conspirators convened in an upper room of Janders and Whipple on Merchant Street. an earlier proposal that the members meet at Hawksworth and Hale having been vetoed because of the fear that Micah Hale, still stoutly attached to the monarchy, might hear of the plot. Wild Whip was concise in his opening statement. Our headstrong queen is to be congratulated. Her silly acts have made revolution obligatory. The Hewlett boys were fearful of overt action and counseled caution, but straightforward John Janders said gruffly, "We've got to overthrow the monarchy in the next 2 days or lose our last opportunity to capture the government." "Do you mean to incite a bloody revolution?" David Hale asked. "If necessary," Janders replied, and no further vote was taken. "Then it's revolution," Whip Hawksworth announced, issuing a statement rather than a question. The committee cheered, and Whip said, "Our plan must be to strike quickly and to gain control of all the main points in the city." "What about the other islands?" one of the Hales asked. "To hell with the other islands," Hawksworth snapped. "The post office, the banks, the palace, the armory. We win them and we control Honolulu. Win Honolulu and we have Hawaii. Janders, tell the committee what you learned today." John Janders rose, coughed, and spoke formally. "This morning I had a 2-hour talk with the American minister, and we studied the law with great care. It is quite clear," he advised me, "that if the revolution quickly acquires control of the major points in Honolulu, so that an observer could logically say, the committee controls the city, the United States will have sufficient cause to contend that we are the de facto government. The minister will promptly recognize us. The monarchy will be at an end, and we will be on our way to incorporation within the United States." "But what about the American troops in the harbor?" one of the Hewlett boys asked. "Will the ship captains send their troops ashore to fight against us?" A broad smile came over the scarred face of Wild Whip as he lounged at the head of the table. The committee looked at him, satisfied that he had uncovered some trick for neutralizing the American forces, but he did not divulge the plan. "Tell them what we arranged, John," he said. Burly John Janders explained, "We have entered into a solemn agreement with the American minister and with the ship captains that as soon as we start the revolution, they will send ashore the maximum number of troops. Their orders will be simple. Protect American lives." "But we're Hawaiian citizens," David Hale protested. "We're also Americans," Janders replied blandly, "and we're the Americans who are going to be protected." Fighting back a sardonic smile, Whip leaned forward across the table and said, "It's a plan that can't fail. We launch our drive against the 10 key targets. Immediately fighting begins, American troops storm ashore. What can the Hawaiians think? They'll reason, the American troops have come to fight against the Queen. So they'll throw down their arms and we'll capture the 10 key spots. And as soon as we control them, the American minister will announce, the United States formally recognizes the de facto government. At that moment, what in hell can the Queen do?" John Janders cried, "How can we lose?" Soberly, David Hale pointed out, "We can lose easily if Uncle Micah appeals to the world powers against our revolution." "He will not do so," Whip promised. "He's a man of great honor," Hale insisted, "and he's sworn allegiance to Hawaii." "It's my job to get Uncle Micah on our side," Whip said flatly. "He'll be there." The Hewlett boys consulted, and one said, "We'll leave the revolution unless we can depend on Micah Hale to represent us before the world." "He will be with us," Whip promised. "Not in the fighting. He's too old a man for that. But when it's over, he'll step forth as our leader." "Can we depend on this?" the Hewlett boys asked. Whip leaped up and crashed his chair aside. "God damn it," he yelled. "If our whole success depends on Micah Hale, do you suppose I'm going to let him escape? Of course you can depend upon it. He'll be with us." Then Janders spoke. "Whip's got to take care of that. We've got to stir up public enthusiasm for the revolution. What we need is a big mass meeting on Monday. Lots of speeches about human decency and men's inalienable rights. But I don't want to see any of this committee making speeches, Whip warned. Get some of the lawyers and men like Cousin Ed Hewlett. He's part Hawaiian and rants well. Things seemed to be going so well that the committee of nine, that is, eight of them, began to relax. The revolution was at hand. The 10 key spots were invested. The American minister had recognized the new government. President Harrison had accepted it as part of the Union. And sugar was more profitable than ever. But Wild Whip brought the conspirators back to reality, pointing out in icy tones, "At the mass meeting on Monday, I want everyone to be within quick reach of his guns." "Will there be trouble?" one of the Hewletts asked. "Not if we're ready for it," Whip replied. As the others quietly left the cellar and circulated through the agitated city, dropping ideas here and there, Wild Whip walked eastward on King Street toward the Hale Mansion across from the palace. And when he reached the white picket fence and the wide green lawns in which Malama Hale took such pride, he nodded graciously to that stately half-Hawaiian lady and asked, "Is Uncle Micah in?" "He's in his study," Malama said gently. Whip entered without knocking, and before he spoke, he closed the door. His uncle was surrounded by his father's missionary books, brought over from Lahaina, and by a substantial theological and legal library. As principal advisor to four kings, he had been required to give many legal opinions, and his fine mind found pleasure in doing so. From the 1870s on, he had paid little attention to the ventures of H&H, leaving that to the Hawksworths and his nephews. He had gladly accepted his proper share of the firm's enormous profits and had applied his income to the betterment of Hawaii. The missionary home for lepers at Kalaupapa, the library, Punahou, and the church had benefited from his charities. But mainly, he had spent his income on helping to run the government efficiently. When one of the kings took a grand tour around the world, stopping off in most of the major capitals, it was Micah Hale who accompanied him at his own expense and who paid for many of the essentials. Most of the legal books owned by the cabinet were also purchased by Micah, for he constantly harangued his contemporaries. "We are all of mission extraction, and until Hawaii is completely stable, the job of our fathers is not completed." No island throughout the Pacific ever had a better public servant than Micah Hale, for if he was liberal with his money, he was thrice generous with his energy. Of the fine laws that were often cited in Europe to prove that Hawaii was civilized, an astonishing proportion had sprung from his energetic mind. And what was remarkable in that period was his capacity to rise above personal interest. Any laws passed in his regime that favored either sugar planters or shippers were proposed not by him, but by the Janderses, the Whipples, and the Hewletts, who proliferated in the government. Four kings had thought of Micah Hale as their one trustworthy American advisor, yet each had known that he favored the ultimate submission of Hawaii to the United States. The present queen knew of his stand, and it had irritated her, and she had dismissed him from all of his offices. He was 70 years old, of better than medium height, stately in bearing, and with a long, spade-like white beard. He dressed only in white, including white powdered shoes, and in public refused to wear glasses. This was the man that faced Whip Hawksworth on the night of Saturday, January 14, 1893. "Uncle Micah," Whip began forthrightly, refusing the chair offered him, "there's bound to be a revolution within the next 2 days." "Have you fomented it?" the spare old man asked. "Yes, sir, I have. And the Hale boys, and the Hewletts, and Janderses. The Whipples have also joined us, and my brother. There can be no retreat." Micah leaned back in his office chair and studied his nephew. "So there's going to be a revolution?" "Yes, sir." Whip was accustomed to addressing older people in the style he had been taught aboard the whaler. "How old are you, Whip?"
36.
"How many wives have you had?"
2.
"How many knife battles in Iwale?"
20, 30.
"How many illegitimate children?"
"I'm supporting half a dozen or more."
"Do you know what they call you around town, Whip?"
"Wild Whip. They call me that to my face. I don't care."
"I wasn't thinking about what they call you to your face. I was thinking of the other name."
"What other name?"
"The Golden Stud. That's how you're known, Whip. And you consider yourself qualified to step forth as the leader of a commune dedicated to the overthrow of a duly constituted government?"
"No, sir, Uncle Micah, I don't."
"I thought you said your group was plotting the revolution."
"We are, and I'm directing it. And when I say fire, by God, sir, we'll fire. So don't be in the way."
"And I'm well qualified to direct a revolution, Uncle Micah, because there's nothing on this earth I fear, and within 2 days I'll have a new government in Hawaii. But I am not qualified to step forth as the public leader of the revolution. You're right on that, and I know it."
"Who is to be the leader?"
"You are."
As Micah gasped at this suggestion, Whip sat down.
The two men, so unalike, stared at each other, and each sensed the tremendous New England force of the other. Micah Hale lived by a code of fierce rectitude, and he persuaded those who associated with him to do the same. While Whip Hawksworth had never outgrown the brawling focussels of the Pacific, he knew that all men were swine and that they enjoyed being kicked into line. Yet on the eve of the revolution, he also knew that certain focal points of history required a man better than himself to stand forth as leader. There were limits to what even Whipple Hawksworth could attain without the assistance of decency.
"This is pretty much a sugar revolution, isn't it, Whipple?" Micah asked.
"From my point of view, yes, sir. From yours, no, sir."
"How can there be two interpretations of an evil act, Whipple?"
"If there weren't two interpretations of our necessary act, Uncle Micah, I wouldn't be here pleading with you. I want a revolution so that sugar will be forever made safe in these islands. You want it so that the islands can join the United States in accordance with a destiny that you foresaw 50 years ago.
Uncle Micah, you've always been right, and you are tonight. Hawaii is doomed unless it contrives some trick to make America accept these islands, and I control that trick. Sir, the only way your dream will ever be realized is through me."
"Not so, Whipple. The day will come when Washington will see the inevitability of annexation."
"Never. Only actions make things inevitable."
"Justice and dawning conscience produce inevitability. Slowly, Washington will see what the right step is, and we must rely upon Washington to take it."
"No. If you live to be 100, you'll die talking about the slow inevitability of justice. There's going to be a revolution, my revolution, and you're going to lead it so that your dream of justice can come true."
Micah Hale rose slowly and stared down at his vigorous young nephew.
"I am appalled, Whipple, that you so misjudged me as to think that I would be partner to such an evil action. I will not divulge your plans, although I should, but now you had better go."
To his surprise, his scar-faced nephew did not rise. Insolently, he kept his position, raised one foot to kick his uncle's chair into place, and said,
"Now we understand each other. Sit down, Uncle Micah, and let's talk about revolution. Let's forget everything we've said so far. And you might as well forget about threatening to divulge our plans to the government. Charlie Wilson knows about them and wanted to arrest us all, but the cabinet didn't have the guts to back him up. So let's see what you and I can do for one another. You despise my position, and I think yours is pathetic. Okay, let's not revert to that again. Uncle Micah, there's going to be a revolution in 2 days. You can't possibly stop it. We've got the American minister waiting on the edge of his chair to recognize our de facto government. We've got American troops out there in the harbor, just itching to swarm ashore and protect decent Americans against Hawaiian savages. We've got our targets pinpointed and our schedules laid. Even if you were to inform the Queen herself, you'd only move up the timetable by the hours you stole from us. He leaned forward and looked hard into his uncle's eyes. It's a revolution, Uncle Micah. Micah Hale was not the kind of man to find his lips going dry at moments of crisis. He had weathered too many abortive revolutions when only his courage had saved the government from irresponsible outrage, and he did not sense any unusual quickening of his pulse now. With eyes as hard as his nephew's, but from a different cause, he said, "You've thought of everything." "Let's accept the revolution as accomplished," the young sugar planter proposed. "I'm not the man who ought to stand before the bar of world opinion and explain why it was necessary. My record wouldn't read very well in London or Berlin. So let's say my part of the revolution has been successful, and that all it represents is my personal greediness. Sugar. Land. What happens then? America won't accept us. Maybe Japan would." The idea that Wild Whip was developing had several other subsidiary clauses, but bearded old Micah Hale did not hear them, for with the mention of the word Japan, he was suddenly transported to the mysterious city of Tokyo in the year 1881, when he served as privy councillor to the last king of Hawaii on the latter's triumphal tour around the world. The royal party was stopping in a Japanese mansion that contained no chairs. The floors were of the most exquisite wood, polished by centuries of use, and the sliding doors were joyous to behold. It was March, and a horde of busy gardeners scurried about pruning pine trees with gnarled red branches. A row of plum trees showed white blossoms. Cherries were eager to burst into bloom. And as the first warm days of the year approached, the Hawaiian party relaxed to enjoy the gracious scenery. Suddenly, Micah had looked up and asked, "Where's the king?" No one knew. At first, there was excitement. Then, as the hours passed, there was panic on the part of both the Americans and the Japanese, for the king of Hawaii was clearly missing. No one had seen him leave the spacious grounds of the mansion, and a frantic search revealed no betraying signs of foul play. He had vanished, a great hulk of a man dressed in conspicuous Western clothes and a long black London tailored coat.